You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Welcome to What's Eric Eating, Culture Map's bi-weekly look at all things Houston bars and restaurants. I'm your host, Culture Map editor Eric Sandler. Today on the show, I'll have a conversation with someone in the food world I think you'll want to hear from. Making his triumphant return to the podcast for the first time since 2018, he is the owner of Melange Creperie in the Heights. Sean Carroll, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Hello, Eric. Nice to see you. Absolutely. And I do hope this return means that I get a return to the fantasy football on my podium again soon as well. We'll see in the fall.
I know. In the interest, I suppose, of full disclosure, we play in a fantasy football league together. We both had not very good seasons. I don't think either one of us made the playoffs.
Oh, I am terrible at that. Absolutely.
But you very graciously... when I text you in July or August to say, are you in? You say yes, which prevents me from having to find a replacement for you, which as men in our 40s, it is surprisingly difficult to find new people to play in your established fantasy football league. So I do appreciate it. And that is the sum total of fantasy football conversation that we will be engaging in today. I could do like a tight 10 minutes about how awesome the pit is with Noah Wiley, but no, let's talk about Melange Creperie because you are celebrating your 15th anniversary next week, I think.
Yes, absolutely. So 15 years since the street stand started over in Montrose at the corner of Westheimer and Taft. And that first day of work, I hauled the cart out there, started up a generator, sat there for 4 or 5.5 hours by myself. I think I was reading The Hunchback of Notre Dame. And then about 15 minutes before closing, one customer came up and was like, I'm sorry, are you selling something? Because this is before food trucks were even cool. And I was like, yes, I have crepes. And I made one. And then just as I'm finishing her crepe, a health inspector shows up. And they're like, what are you doing here? Nobody's got a permit for this around here. You know, like that's not right. And they looked at all my paperwork, said, okay, you know, but you're going to have to close and I'll be back tomorrow morning to, you know, verify everything with the city of Houston. So a very ignoble start to the first day.
Say a little more about that because it is this kind of crazy. It's hard to imagine Houston food in 2010 where... Yeah, I mean, Twitter's a thing, but like Instagram hasn't really taken off yet. Facebook groups, which are like the primary means of conversation about restaurants like on social media in the city, didn't exist yet. And the food truck phenomenon, you were like 6 months to a year ahead of the curve of food trucks being a popular, like modern food trucks, not like the ones that service like, you know, job sites or whatever, but like. Like the modern wave of food trucks was you're a little bit ahead of the curve. So
yeah.
So how did you even get this notion that you wanted to sell crepes on the side of the street in Houston where, you know, it's not like the weather's like awesome to be outside all the time.
Well, I grew up in Buffalo and that's up in New York. I traveled to New York City and around the Northeast as a kid. I had seen the guys, you know, selling Euros, selling hot dogs, stuff like that. And it started off in 2008 when I was working in art. I had worked at a museum, a gallery, and a website. And over the course of 2008, 2009, as the economy collapsed, then I lost 3 jobs in a row and said, screw it, I'm going to go stand on a street corner. So it was kind of that thought of before, but also I would put it a little bit to art as well, because in order to make crepes, I tried every crepe in town, but also I just wanted something that was performative that people could watch. And so that was really nice to come across a food that was, you're conversational. It's a little bit of that barista, bartender, 3, 4 minute interaction thing. And that really appealed to me. But when I went to get my permits, I, was informed that there was a Hot Nuts kiosk in the Galleria Mall, and a guy who sold hot dogs outside of a Sellers Brothers, which is a very old school grocery store on the southeast side. And other than that, there was no food trucks, I'm sorry, food stands in Houston whatsoever. So I was ahead of it, and then after a few months of being open, was happy that Twitter was cool and people started picking up on what's going on, looking for things out there. And that because of LA and the food truck kind of renaissance that was happening there, all of a sudden reporters were looking for, hey, what's the new food truck in your town? Go report on them. And there wasn't enough of the first gen to crowd me out. So I was included with them and was happy to ride the tide.
Yeah, and I think I just think about my own visits to the stand back in the day, and I mean, yes, the crepe was tasty, but it really was about that sort of patter, like your little your vamping that you did, like while you were making the crepes, and that interaction with people that I think really helped build your following.
I gotta put it a little bit to the Eatsy Boys, another one of that first gen, food trucks, who started a few months after me, and I loved it. The three of them came out, got a crepe, were talking about how's it going on the street out here, but they did the right thing. They paid for food, and then they asked me questions about my business. Like you gotta put a little skin in the game first. And one of the three, I'm gonna say it was Matt Marcus, said, food is 51% about the service. And I was like, no, that can't be right. It's all about how it tastes, in a black box, like what does the food taste like? And he really convinced me that it was about the environment and how it is served to you that literally can make food taste better. So over the years, we've had a few different evolutions, and I've had to change for sure from seeing someone in a Cleveland Browns t-shirt and making fun of them for a couple of minutes about that. To dealing with, like a food hall for a while and then on to a restaurant situation and the very different clientele of what they expect in those kind of interactions.
Yeah, and the service is important, but it is also about that crepe. And I think for me, what sets your crepe apart is that it's browner and caramelized and crispier than some of these other places around town where they're, well, I guess the opposite of crispy is soggy, or if I really wanted to be mean about it, limp.
We'll go with fluffy. We'll call him fluffy.
Yeah, sure. Chewy as opposed to crispy.
There's two different styles actually. And when I was in Paris back in 2008 and I had a crepe, and I tell you what, as a Texan in Paris in March, I was holding on to it for dear life. Like it was just freezing cold, and I was like, this warm pocket in my hand is the only thing keeping me alive. But coming back to town and trying all the different ones around town, I couldn't find a recipe online that fit with it. And I just wanted to make them like that street food style, which is very different from, it's kind of an American 1970s thing to have a soft crepe like that. And you're just have soft ingredients inside. You slice it with a fork, and it's just a different provenance. I'll use the art history term, versus what the kind of French do. And I did find a recipe. You had mentioned 40 somethings before, so this is only for the 40 somethings to say. I found the recipe on GeoCities, which was a blogging site. And it was about a month or two before the whole thing collapsed, like they shut it down. But I read a recipe of a man telling a story about his grandmother from Quebec, and it was the only one I found that was a different proportion. And so I tried it. I was like, That's what I'm looking for. It wasn't until a year and a half later when I was making crepes at Summerfest on Allen Parkway for a big festival that a woman accosted me. She ordered a crepe. She came back and she was like, "What the heck? Where did you get this recipe?" She hauled out, like, she had a Britannian flag with her. And she's like, "I'm from Brittany. Nobody knows this recipe. You are using a Southern Britannian recipe. So I can tell Texans I'm using the Southern recipe. And it's crispier. It's higher in egg. It's lower in flour. And it makes a big difference. It's like in how it's supposed to be served."
Well, and then the other thing is, you have your classic banana Nutella or banana strawberry Nutella, the kind of seminal sweet crepe that everybody knows and likes. But then you make all these like fun savory crepes too that are, I mean, a ham and cheese, obviously, but then, just kind of driving around Houston, like trying different foods and being like, oh, I could do that as a crepe.
Yes, no, that's a good way to put it. Driving around Houston because, the idea of fusion for sure, is a thing, but it's more like I just want to get to all the cultures in town. So we've done over 950 different specials in the past 15 years, and we're going to try to get to every culture in town. We're just trying new foods and foods that are eaten here and then putting them inside of a crepe because every culture has a flatbread. Like they're all related on this fundamental level. And I love that. But the funny thing is, I'll put something Mexican on the menu, every Indian family will order it. I put something Indian on the menu, every Mexican family will order it. And it's this concept as well of like, are you familiar with the dish? But if you're too familiar, mom makes it better. Mom can beat me. Absolutely. It's just gotta be like a little different, not something that you have at home.
Yeah, so I mean, what are some of your favorites that you've done? You don't have to like try to dig your memory banks for all 15 years, but just recently, like what are some of the ones that come to mind?
So, Eric, my answer in the restaurant when somebody says that, and I'm like, oh, we've done all these ones before, is, oh, my favorite is the one that you ordered.
That's smart.
But I understand the point of the question for sure. And doing things like Trinidad doubles, which is a spicy chickpea curry, with some kind of Indian chutneys on top of it. But that kind of mix of where Indian food, Caribbean food come together. I love doing something like a butter and jam, or like cream cheese and an exotic jam. In February and January, when it's like cold out, and doing something Scandinavian. So, pulling out some lingonberry, cloudberry, something like that, that's real simple. But then again, there's like, a gonzo one, starting off with the food trucks back in the day, there was the farm to table, and then there was also the gonzo, the people who put, like a donut and made a burger out of it. And so, we'll have like the El Jefe breakfast taco, and it's got potatoes, cheese, black bean, ham, avocado, salsa that we make ourselves, just everything all in a crepe. Absolutely.
All right. So as you mentioned, you've been on a journey. You started on Westheimer, right? Out there on the street in the elements. You were a food hall pioneer. You were at was it conservatory back then, right? The first
The
conservatory
conservatory was
downtown.
the first one in town, absolutely.
Yeah. And now you're in Montrose, or sorry, not in Montrose. You were supposed to be in Montrose. You've been in the Heights for a long time. What have you kind of noticed about these kind of different serving environments? I mean, what have you kind of noticed about the evolution of your customers? Because I would think that it was hardest to sort of lure people to Westheimer to stand out in the heat and the cold, and maybe the easiest to be in a shopping area that's as busy as Heights Mercantile. But just kind of talk about the evolution of these different environments where you've had the restaurant.
Yeah, so it goes with kind of the social media or how you hear about restaurants. Eric, you noticed over the years how things changed. We had kind of the Twitter one where people were chasing down trucks. Where are you going to be today? What's your new special? And people were hanging on every word of these people, but it was a direct connection to the Instagram thing of like, does it look pretty? And I loved it. I think it was Miss from Fluff Bake Bar who had some choice thoughts. When Instagram was like at its peak, and there would be like ice cream shops in town where it looked beautiful, but they were like buying dryers at a grocery store and piling whipped cream and putting sparklers in the ice cream, and it was like it looks good, but how does it taste? And
Yeah,
then
that was
now,
where rolled ice cream really let us down, right? It looked
yes.
awesome. It made for a great picture, and it was icy. It wasn't creamy. It was like such a bummer, but yes.
Yeah, so from that then on to, as you say, the Facebook groups, people are talking to each other, and kind of this, thread all the way through of, it's word of mouth. It's always word of mouth. And in the case of being in Montrose and having a street stand, that was people who had traveled. That was really nice. There were so many universities nearby and professors who lived nearby, and college students who were looking for something cheap and easy. Oh, this was in there as well, as we were inside the HEB Montrose for a year. So we were inside the grocery store, and that was my, kind of first introduction to, moms with kids for sure. And that worked out well to be like a, kind of bonus item inside the grocery store. But we did it for a year. HEB had these plans. They went by the wayside, and that was before the food hall, which in a way felt like taking that old school Wild West that everybody was at, that Twitter nest, of like you can go wherever you want, you can do what you want, you can drive your cattle all the way to Kansas City. And then they put barbed wire around everybody. And the invention of barbed wire was the invention of the food hall. And it meant that you were paying rent, you were in the same spot, you can find us all the time. And that was just a double-edged sword. You knew exactly where somebody was going to be and when they were open, which was good. We weren't exactly consistent back in the day, but it did mean that your overhead consistently went up and you were in competition in a small space with stuff. So in downtown, it was interesting. I had to once again explain, like what a crepe is. And my default, if I'm ever talking to someone from outside the loop or hasn't traveled outside of Texas, is to say, I make pancake tacos. And everybody loves pancakes and everybody loves tacos. You got to have that elevator pitch, absolutely. And then moving on to the Heights, it became a different thing. I got people who are on their cell phone, walking up, ordering something, like I'll have a caramel macchiato. And I'm like, sorry, ma'am, this isn't a Starbucks. And it just was, dealing with kind of the evolution of the customer to us. And we've always been good at breeding regulars, come and try and have a crepe, see the environment. And then I love it that we see people again and again. But now to offer people the amenities like air conditioning and restrooms, is very nice for sure. And to just, kind of sit down and have this consistency as well as an opportunity to use it as a platform, because now we have our own space. We'll do things like poetry readings. We'll do political fundraisers. People can have their meetings there and stuff like that. French groups will come by with 10 to 20 people, and it's nice to use that as a platform to kind of like do other things.
Yeah, and I mean, how long have you been in the Heights? It's been a long time at this point, hasn't it?
We opened a month after Harvey, and the reason we didn't open a month, but like directly after Harvey, was that I was supposed to sign the paperwork saying that we were taking control of the space and everything looks good, and Harvey happened, and they had installed the flashing backwards, so above all of the windows, instead of these little metal things pushing out the water, it just said, "Come on in," and all of the sheetrock right above the windows just turned into mush and fell down, and we got it fixed relatively quickly. But that was chaos right after that. And we spent a lot of time. We spent an extra month and a half in the food hall, making crepes and bringing them to George R. Brown. We would, because I had to keep employees going. I had to keep moving material. You can't just let it sit there, like you have to. If you slice ham, you got to use it. If you buy bananas, you got to use them. And we just make crepes and give them away because nobody was coming to work downtown. The whole city was paralyzed. And so that pushing forward was important. And then we finally got to open In the Heights, and I think we were the first or second In the Heights Mercantile to open. So, making the Heights go from a sleepy neighborhood, which we remember it was, not a lot of people remember how quiet the Heights used to be, to, like it's bustling these days.
Well, yeah, I mean, if we go back just a little bit farther, like to when Cultivari opened at the beginning of 2014, it was like Liberty Kitchen and Stella Sola, I think, had come and gone by then. So that was, but like, there was Shade on 19th Street or whatever. Like, there wasn't a whole lot. And not BRC, Glass Wall, right? In 2012 or whatever, Glass Wall was the best restaurant in the Heights. And so it's been. Now it's, one of the premier, two or three best neighborhoods for dining in the whole city, but it wasn't always like that. So talk about that evolution. I mean, you've kind of seen it. You're kind of post-revival market, post-Cultivare, but like pre a lot of the other restaurants that are really staples in that neighborhood. So how, what have you noticed as the way things have changed in the Heights?
Yeah, we stay a lot. We stay out of a lot of the let's say like biggest times. Those Saturday Sunday nights on White Oak on 6, they're just banging out there, absolutely. And we're just outside that, Lights in the Heights. What is it? White Linen Nights. Like those are just barely outside of our purview. So we're right on the edge of like a lot of stuff, but I like it as a chill and easy thing to do, especially like ones and twos, big groups are great, absolutely. Let us know ahead of time. But at the same time, that Heights bike trail is right there, and I love that that's like a little bit of just kind of like people walking, people biking, people enjoying themselves. It's not Central Park, but like there's very few places in the city where you get kind of the mixture of you're able to stop and do stuff, but you're able to be outside and enjoy nature. So there's a Donovan Park across the street, right along Heights. They're installing a new one right now. A whole bunch of sculptures that go up. The Redbud Gallery curates, and it's just really chill. It's busy in terms of how many cars are there and the stuff like that. But you park, you can go around to four or five different things in the local area just by walking around. And it feels very different than Houston, which is so car based.
Yeah, it does have that kind of walkable quality, and there aren't very many neighborhoods like that. Rice Village comes to mind as kind of the most. And when I lived in Montrose, kind of near the Manil, you could walk to a bar or restaurant or do something at the Manil and then walk home or whatever. But that part of the Heights is special in that way. And the other thing I like about Heights Mercantile is it seems like there's a lot of programming, like events and stuff that are happening there. I know they have the farmers market a couple times a month. There's other sort of coordinated events. So there's always people being brought to that center, apart from, whether they, want to patronize your restaurant or local foods or, buy a pair of glasses or whatever else is going on over there.
Yeah, it's the, we're talking about the history of it in 15 years and stuff like that. And I would say that 15 years ago, that old school methodology still was around where you didn't want competition. Like you wanted to be the only one on the block selling food so that everyone who lived nearby would come to you. And then the kind of communal way of looking at things came around. And I really like that this evolution has, kind of taken over to where a rising tide lifts all boats. And so they designed it in the first place so that Postino's for the night, local foods right next door to us for lunch, us there for breakfast. And we're open 8 a.m. till 8 p.m. But we, dovetail with the other things around there very well in the events that they put together doing the farmers market. There's one coming up this Sunday, so it's every other Sunday. They do craft markets before the different holidays when you need a last minute gift for mom or dad or right before Christmas and stuff. But it's activating that space, which, it's it's great as a walkable area, and then sometimes you just need to fill it with stuff, and we all benefit from it. It just kind of fits together well, and so it's like a long-term design of like this putting together, and our property manager being very good about working on those short-term things of introducing people to the space. I mean, we've been there since 2017, like I said, and still I get people coming in going, "I didn't know you were here." And I'm like, "Oh yeah, been here, been here."
Well, I mean, sort of the other thing is, you used to kind of be a media darling. I won't take all the credit for that. Obviously, Allison Cook was a huge fan of yours and did a lot to raise awareness, even making you one of the top 10 restaurants in Houston one year on her top 100. But, I think it's hard to be as established as you are and still be in the mix for kind of coverage and stuff. So maybe just kind of talk about your like building a brand when you're not the new kid anymore, and but you still want to introduce yourself to new people all the time.
Oh, for sure. Like, I think I could clock this from far away, like before it happened, but I could see it and I was like, okay, I just need to wait until, right around this moment. It might come up soon, we'll see. But you get the new things, you're the new guy, that's awesome, that's great. You're at the cutting edge of this is interesting, this is new. And then you stick around and you're doing similar things for quite a while, you're not new anymore. And there are great restaurants in this city that stick around forever. I'm going to shout out Cali Sandwich in that respect because, it takes perseverance to get from new and exciting to classic. And you just kind of got to put your head down. You can't complain about, like, I know there's new things. There's that, when we started, Houston did not have, a thing about Korean food, there was not, all these places that were opening the steakhouse revival and stuff like that. And so as trends change and come and go, if you're doing the same thing, and just kind of being consistent and doing good at your one thing that you do, just keep at it, but you do have that gap between when you're new, maybe you get 3 to 5 years, and when you're classic. And when you're classic, that's great, but you really got to grab onto that. And you really got to say, like, I'm here, I've been here for a while, and I come by and see us, and some people might be like, oh, this is classic. I had no idea that it even existed at all. But you see the example of things like Lola, great restaurant in the Heights that just closed. And it's, you're classic and you have to be pushing that. You have to be saying, been around here for a while. Lola was there for 18 years, and they really had established themselves. But when the new stuff comes up, and especially the social media and how people hear about things changes, you have to change with it. Absolutely.
Yeah, and I wrote that article about Lola closing, and I looked it up on Instagram, and I think they only had like a couple thousand followers on Instagram, and it's like, that's not enough, right? That's not enough engagement. That's not seeking attention in a way that makes you feel relevant. But it is kind of funny, because I mean, this show is very focused on new and all that, and Culture Map readers are very engaged with that. But I also do that segment on Houston Public Media once a month. And there it's like that audience is so broad. And I'm mindful of the idea that people move to Houston all the time, or they may be listening to that show for the first time. And so whenever we talk about, if we're talking about Tex-Mex, for example, yeah, I want to mention whatever's new and exciting. I mean, Candente is not new anymore, but for a while it was Candente. Now maybe it's Kitchen and Cantina, or maybe even Tocamadera if we're getting really off the board. But at the same time, it's like, okay, but we also have to mention Papacitos and Ninfa's on Navigation, because or if we or a friend of mine who's very active on Instagram, like very into the food scene, was looking for a breakfast option near downtown that was open before 7 a.m. A lot of breakfast places don't open until 7. And so I started Googling around, thinking about places that I know for breakfast. And Via Arcos opens at 6 or 6:30, whatever it is. And he had never heard of Via Arcos before. And it's like, Like, this is the definitive Houston, one of them. No disrespect to Laredo Taqueria or some of the others, but that's like on the very short list of the most enduring breakfast taco destinations. But even this person who's very engaged in the food scene had never been there before or heard of it. And so I sent him there and he's like, oh my God, this is awesome. Like, why haven't I don't know why you've never heard of it, but yes, I'm so glad that I was able to introduce it to you. And I kind of feel that way about Melange. It's like I don't have a reason to talk about Melange Crêperie very often, because how often do crepes come up? But in the right environment, like, oh, where can I get breakfast in the Heights, or who can I talk to that's like very engaging, that like really understands service and is engaging and an affordable, like not in a fine dining context, but in like an affordable. It's like, oh, you got to go meet Buffalo Sean. He's the best, but you just don't, you're not front of mind anymore in the same way that you were, when you were out, when the cart was so novel, or even when you first moved into the Heights and there was so much less going on up there.
No, it's time. And like, what is it? It's about to be baseball season, right? Let's go with
Yeah, it's
baseball.
spring training. Yeah.
You're thinking about your pitching rotation, and you're about to do your big thing. You are figuring out who to start. Well, it's a 7-game series, and so, or you got a whole season. Like, are you actually going to put your best pitcher in, wear them out in the beginning of the season? No, absolutely. You're going to try and see how the new guys do. Maybe one of them will pop off and be actually, amazing for sure. But over this long period of time, they'll pop up and they'll make an impression. You know that they're dependable and they've been there for a while. And I hope my metaphor is landing. I'm losing it as I'm doing it, but
Well,
at the
you
same
know what's
time.
funny is you're a big football fan, and so you're sort of trying to riff on baseball, and I'm like, you're a huge Bills fan, and it's like I think of a restaurant like Melange Crêperie, like you're not the quarterback, you're not the receiver, you're not the flashy defensive end, you're like the right guard, where it's like, you don't notice them very often, except when they make a mistake, but the teams with good right guards tend to get a little farther in the season, right? They're more likely to make the playoffs and win games than teams that don't have that. And the food scene, we need restaurants like Melange Crêperie. It's like it's not the flashiest thing in the world. It's not it's you know the influencers aren't flogging a Melange Crêperie. Although, if any the influencers who are listening to this, like if you've never been, go, like please go, because I think you'll be really pleasantly surprised by it. But this is what adds like color and spice to the food scene, are these like little neighborhood places that do one thing really, really well. And so I mean that, if anything, and also I just like talking to you, which is why when you reached out, I was like, yeah, come on, like sure, it's been far too long. Come hang with me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I'm gonna stick with that. Yeah, there's no fantasy football stats for the right guard. You don't gain points or lose points, for that. Nothing you can do to measure it other than hope that you're dependable and still there, but that's, and I'm gonna make the big plea, when you see places that are closing like that, that are dependable and been around for a long time and stuff like that. Pay attention to your right guard. Make sure that they're taken care of, because even if the new guy is flashy, or the wide receiver is getting a big payout this year or something, that's part of the whole scene, COVID, when that happened, and living through that was very interesting to see how a community can come together. And I loved that we had those first few months, and I was an insomniac, like, oh my gosh, I'm gonna get sued by everybody, I'm gonna lose everything. And we went with, what did we do after Harvey? Okay, we gave away food. All right, do that. And we just looked up, like, okay, who is around that needs support in this time? The firefighters, the nurses, the police force, and schools and teachers. And we would just ask people, buy gift cards, and we will turn around and give that away, and put it out on social media, do what you can. And that read us through kind of that period of just like having to keep employees on the payroll, having to keep rolling through food, and whether people were giving money or not, we were going to do it. So it's just give away what you can when you can afford it, and just count on that community, to kind of roll through. So I was very happy to, even if, we had fallen into that gap between what's new and what's classic, to know that there was community support there. In person coming in, ordering stuff, as well as just being like, good, glad for what you're doing, what you are as a part of the community.
Well, and even more recently, you're a maker, as you said. You're a little more egg in the dough. Everybody likes a breakfast sandwich with a fried egg in it, and you guys make a version of that. So, how are you dealing with the price of eggs right now?
The egg thing. Okay, so maybe unbeknownst to other people, but this has happened two other times since COVID. And both times it was bird flu. And they culled huge amounts of birds, but it did not end up kind of like getting to the retail point of that, because so many of the large people, the Krogers, the Costcos and stuff out like that, they make a contract. Oh, we're in Houston, let's use the oil thing. They make a contract on futures. And they made a contract and we're buying the eggs, we're doing this, and you got to honor your contract. So the producers were eating crow for a while. And this time it got into the market. And if anybody else doesn't know, the eggs, especially the retail white eggs, are traded like a stock, just like corn futures and stuff like that. And so in going to different distributors, I would do different things like, okay, I know the price in market value is going up. I'm going to go somewhere that has, a longer term contract, go to Kroger's, go to Costco. And then when the price was coming down, not worry about those futures contracts places and go to where someone is doing market rate the base the day of. Now we're in a situation where we've gone to my local farms and been like, hey, can we get in on your route, and that's very nice, because even if they're selling it at a higher price than what we can get otherwise, it's consistent, and we're happy to know that we can do that. And basically getting into the brown egg game, which is not determined by a futures market, even though the product is exactly the same on the inside.
Right. Tastes the same, like works the same in your recipes, all that stuff.
Yeah, so now we're still bouncing back and forth between different things going on. We will have to adjust prices as this goes on, but a temporary shock, really should not be making people make these drastic changes in prices, even if they're an egg-dependent restaurant, if they are able to look at all the different distribution variables out there and really play the game. I've always been one to spend time rather than money for something. I will go to five different places to get the right product, to get it local when I can, and not compromise on what's going into the food. But it does definitely take a bit to build up those relationships and be able to go from one person to the next. So we'll see if this tamps down as previous ones have. Or if it accelerates, which, yeah, that's going to be tough in the next 6 months. Oh, Easter is coming up. That's going to mess everybody up.
I don't know what the alternative to dyeing Easter eggs is.
Potatoes.
There might be a lot of paper mache. I don't know. Well, a lot of tie-dye t-shirts for Easter this year. Not so much egg hunts or plastic eggs are going to be real big this year.
Dye some potatoes, hide them around in the yard. Absolutely.
The other thing is you've been in the Heights for so long. I mean, do you think about expanding? Do you want to do a second location of Melange somewhere? And do you have an idea about kind of where in the city you'd like to be?
I mean, it's always possible. I'm not going to put past anything, but there are kind of two ways that restaurants open, like you're either coming from the kind of chef-driven way, which is how I did it, or you're coming from the business side and you're like, wow, I would really like this. Let's assemble a team. And if you're coming with a lot of capital, cool, good for you, absolutely. You're coming as the kind of chef driven, you're cobbling it together. And I'm very happy for the investors that I have and that I've been able to work with. But the idea of a raise makes my hair fall out very quickly. And the prices have changed a lot. So since 2017 and just the inflation, materials costs and stuff like that, the prices have changed a lot. So it would be possible. Not going to say it couldn't, but I would definitely think about as far as a place to do one. In Spring Branch for sure, which I think is really coming up, and a lot of people are moving there, and that's terribly interesting. Doing one all the way out in Katy, where you have the Asian and Latin American communities that are very familiar with crepes. Much more so than than an American audience, or to do something in kind of the southeast side, like the East End, getting down towards the end and stuff like that. And in that case, it'd be very interesting to open one up, have it be Spanish language, and call it Crepa Mixa.
The other thing that I was sort of wondering about is, because, for me, the draw initially was you, right? And obviously you can't, you've got a restaurant that's open 7 days a week. You can't make all the crepes. No one would expect you to. But what has it been like? But you still want that interaction, that like that's such a core component of the Melange experience. So what has it been like sort of training minions, maybe not to quite do you? Like, I don't, if somebody else was like, heck yeah, I'd be confused, right? I think they'd be sort of almost making fun of you if they were imitating your specific style of speech. But what has it been like to kind of, not just teach them to make crepes, but also like teach them to engage with customers while they're making crepes?
Make it your own. Exactly. And if I can say this about the sweet stand days and starting to train my first couple of people, it was very interesting to work with them. Be like, this is what you say, this is what you do, this is how you're working. And I do remember one of my employees. I had a habit of saying when I drop a crepe, people are directly there watching, and I drop a crepe and maybe it tore a little hole in it or something, and I'd take a little batter and I'd fill it in, and I'd be like, I do love that crepes are so forgiving, just like my wife. And then I heard one of my employees say, oh, I do love, he drops a crepe, spins it, tears a hole in it, and says, oh, I do love that crepes are so forgiving, just like Sean's wife. And I was like, no, that's not going to work out for you. It was very cool to see as people started making it their own. And that is both in English and Spanish. For sure, the ways that people engage with the audience and decide to, say things, and I just ask about someone's day, comment on things, stuff like that, is great because everyone has their own, version of it. We do this with the radio in the shop. Anyone can play what they want to when they're working, so we have days when it's, half K-pop and then half Selena. Someone's playing 1960s jazz, and then, techno from the early 2000s. Not too hardcore, but something. And it's just let this evolve and let this change and let this mold to make, the employees comfortable so that they feel like they're in a space in order to kind of push things and be comfortable enough to be themselves.
All right. Well, I have to say that kind of brings me to the end of my questions. I mean, we've been at this for 35, 40 minutes. So let me just ask you, is there anything else you'd like to discuss since you're here? Or give me the big picture. I mean, 15 years is a long time by any restaurant standard. So, how do you feel about kind of reaching this milestone? Did you think when you were out there on Westheimer in 2010 that, you'd be still be making crepes 15 years later?
I just wanted to make a living. But I did know at a certain point, my knees couldn't take it. The whole thing of, the street stand, hauling things out, every day, setting up, breaking down completely and stuff, it had to evolve and grow. And as that 5 years of the street stand, came to an end, There were so many of the early food trucks, that first gen of them, that were getting into restaurants that were opening places. Eatsy Boys, which then turned into Eighth Wonder. Good Dog Hot Dog over there in the Heights. The second gen coming in, and those guys sometimes doing incredibly well for themselves. Waffle Bus and stuff like that. And everybody was moving in. You have to grow and you have to evolve. So I'm very happy that I have, gotten into a place, got a good long lease on it. I can see the end from here of like, okay, that was a good run, and I'll go on and do something completely different. But that's 8 years down the way. I'm gonna get to 20. I'm gonna see where it goes. And as per your question, before, I would love the idea of putting together a program and being able to pitch it as a franchise kind of idea. And that's the same thing of make it your own, take it to a different neighborhood, take it to a different community, and mold kind of like what your standard crepes are in order to fit what's going on. It's great to have gone this far, and I'm absolutely grateful for, the grace that the universe has given me in that case. But I also know that nothing lasts forever. And so I in that respect, I'm very happy to have been a part of the Houston community, the food industry, see everything as it grows and evolves. And I'm just going to keep rolling with the punches, as it goes. Prices are crazy out there. On the inside, it's very difficult for a lot of people to know what the daily thing of a running a restaurant is. And we're always going to kind of couch it in like, yeah, I'm doing okay. If some restaurateur tells you, oh, I'm doing amazing, yeah, they're not telling the truth. There are always problems going on, and you run from one disaster to the next. But I've settled into being okay with that, and I'm very happy to keep going. Absolutely.
Well, Sean, I guess that does bring me to the end. So why don't you give us the social media and the website for Melange Crêperie? How can people stay in touch?
Yeah, everyone can find us online, Melange Crêperie. Just look us up on Facebook or on Instagram. And on Instagram, it's all lowercase, all one word, Melange Crêperie. Have that on Twitter as well. And I think I need to make a blue sky and do the same thing as well. But Instagram
Maybe
is where
a
I definitely
TikTok,
post things.
embrace
TikTok,
modernity.
there might I think that there is a TikTok because I have a social media person, and there might be a TikTok out there for Melange Crêperie. This is the old man talking, saying, I believe there's a TikTok. We'll see if there's a TikTok.
All right, fair enough. All right, Sean, this was a lot of fun. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can follow me on Instagram at Eric Sandler. Keep it locked on culturemap.com for all the latest Houston bar and restaurant news. This is your periodic reminder that you can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I always appreciate your ratings and reviews. You can email me, Eric, ERIC, at culturemap.com with any questions or comments. And if you do leave a rating, like Katie Nolan used to say, only if it's 5 stars and only if it's nice. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be back next week.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. At ziprecruiter.com/zip. That's ziprecruiter.com/zip. ziprecruiter.com/zip.